bad to edit it out. Y'all can still talk. It's okay. I'm not recording you. I have 20 more seconds, so we'll wait. So we're on time. You have to help me end on time, though, so I don't go over. At least there's a clock back there. It's relatively accurate, so we'll be okay.
They made this last one a real hard choice.
Oh, yeah.
But this is one of those, I think this is one of those pounding questions.
Oh, yeah?
That pretty much, yeah, that believers and non-believers would ask.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope I say something worth hearing. All righty. Well, thank you guys for coming. I hope you're having a great day. We're, I guess, just over halfway done now, so you got a whole nother day to drink from the fire hose, and Joshua McDowell after this tonight, so you don't want to miss that. My name's Adam Tucker. I'm the Director of Missions and Evangelism at SES. So I run our ministry called TEAM, which means we send out students and alumni and sometimes faculty wherever we're invited to teach apologetics, philosophy, biblical studies, those sorts of things. Some of my guys in here to heckle me, so that's always good. But seriously, if we can serve you in any way, your church, youth group, Sunday school class, parachurch ministry, whatever it may be, we're here to serve you. So please stop by the booth or talk to me afterwards, and we'll hook up and see what we can do to help you out, or any other way that SES can serve you. So I want to start out with just something that I like to think about from my childhood. So my mom was in choir when I was growing up, and so the cool thing was, we got plenty of chairs over here. The cool thing was all the kids, you know, we're probably 10, 11, 12 years old, we would get together and play hide-and-go-seek while our moms and dads were at choir practice on Wednesday nights. It was just the thing to do, you know. And so we built this new sanctuary, and it had all these classrooms on the bottom floor, and a lot of them were connected. It was one long hallway and classrooms on each side. Come on in. We got plenty of seats. You're right on time. And so our new sanctuary underneath had this one long hallway, classrooms on each side, and the rooms connected to each other. So we would turn, there was a room at the end of the hallway. We would turn the light on, crack the door a little bit, flip all the other lights off, and play hide-and-go-seek in the dark. The water fountain was base. So you had to get the water fountain before you got tagged. And you're hiding in the shadows, and under the desk, under the chairs, all the stuff, with this one little light at the end of the hall, just so we didn't kill each other and run into the wall or anything else. But it was a blast. But that reminds me of the issue we want to talk about tonight, because it seems at times that God's playing hide and seek with us. We're kind of in the dark with this faint little light at the end of the hall, trying to feel our way through this world and wondering at times, God, if you're there, why is it still so dark? Why are you playing hide and seek, as it were? And it seems even in the Bible we see a hint at this in a few different places. But one is Acts 17, where Paul says, "From one man, he's made every nation of men to live all over the earth and has determined their appointed times and the boundaries of where they live, so that they might seek God, and perhaps they might reach out and find him, though he is not far from each of us." But if God loves us so much, why do we have to seek him and reach for him? Why isn't he just more obvious? I think these are questions that are often used in an attempt, and in a positive attempt, to disprove the existence of God. Let me give you an example of this. If you're familiar with Richard Carrier, a popular internet atheist, this is from a debate he did a few years ago. He says, if Jesus was a God and really wanted to save the world, he would have appeared and delivered his gospel personally to the whole world and would still be doing so. I would do so if I were in his position, and God can't be more compassionate than I am in that respect. That's from a 2010 debate with Mike Lacona. You may be familiar with the quote from the philosopher Bertrand Russell. Someone asked him, he's an atheist, and he said, you know, if you get to heaven and God says, why didn't you believe in me? His response was, God, you gave us insufficient evidence. Now, I think this is an important issue because it's really gaining in popularity. Come on in the house. We still have seats. It's really gaining in popularity as an argument against God and something I think in our culture Christians are struggling more and more with. And really one reason I even kind of ventured into this topic was because of conversations that I was having with people on Facebook and elsewhere that I didn't really have good answers to at the time. And you may finish tonight and think you still don't have a good answer, but we're going to try. So Dr. Michael J. Murray puts it this way. He says, I expect this argument, one of two fairly new arguments for atheism, will in the next generation be taken by many to be the most compelling reason to accept atheism. And again, it's not just atheists. This is an issue that Christians deal with as well. From the traditional aspect of why isn't God's existence more evident, to maybe more subtle things like, and I've heard this a lot, why doesn't God speak to me? You know, we use that language all the time. Why don't I feel certain things when I pray? Why don't I experience God in some way that I think I should be experiencing? And I think in an attempt to answer arguments like Carrier, like Russell, some Christians unfortunately go to the opposite extreme. And we see things like this from the new movie, The Atheist Delusion. This is from the promotional material. Comfort says, having to prove the existence of God to an atheist is like having to prove the existence of the sun at noon on a clear day. And some people would say, hey, amen, absolutely. And I would humbly suggest this response is just as bankrupt as Carrier's argument. Because we don't experience God like we see the sun at noon on a clear day. And we'll get into why that's the case in just a minute. So again, I think it's important we answer this, we don't sweep it under the rug, and we try to think well about this issue. Now obviously that's going to require doing some philosophy. It's going to require doing some theology. And since you're at a three-day national conference on Christian apologetics, I'm guessing you guys are okay with that. We got a couple more seats down front in the splash zone. And I'm going to get some water so I can actually splash. Come on in. We'll tell you how to do it. Yes. God's hidden us. Yep. Yeah, I thought about having all the lights off when you guys came in and just starting off in the dark. All right, so we're going to do some philosophy. We're going to do some theology. Things you all do all the time. Hopefully will help you do it well. And hopefully some of you are already doing it well rather than poorly. So here's what we want to do in our time together. I think we can be better equipped to understand this problem of God's hiddenness by looking at three critical concepts that I want us to engage with tonight. So the first one is, excuse me, how we know. How we as human beings come to have knowledge of reality. Okay? So I'm convinced, and this is what we teach at the seminary as well, that as human beings, all of our knowledge begins in sense experience. That doesn't mean it's limited to sense experience, but it begins in sense experience. Now, I have three little boys, 6, 3, and about 6 months. And having kids has been the greatest lesson in epistemology that I think you could have. Epistemology is just the study of how we know. And seeing them grow and learn and experience reality has just, you know, been a firsthand experience of this process of sensing things and learning about things and reasoning about things, drawing conclusions about things. They didn't come into the world understanding the Trinitarian God, or knowing that the Bible's true, or knowing that that's a dog or a tree or whatever. They experience reality and draw conclusions from that. That's a whole other topic that we could talk about and how all that works. But when it comes to God, we reason from effect, from things, to cause, to God, just as Romans 1 talks about. And so we're still, our knowledge of God is beginning in sense experience, even though in our reasoning process, we're moving beyond sense experience when it comes to our conclusions about God. So from this knowledge of reality, physical reality, we're able to draw reasonable conclusions, even necessary conclusions, about the nature of God and many aspects of His hidden attributes, divine nature, again, just as Romans 1 talks about, and we can conclude that God is unlimited being itself, the great I am. And as being itself, God can't be confined to a specific location or to a specific parcel of matter or a specific time or any other limiting factor, because that makes God a creature, excuse me, instead of the creator, if he's limited in any way whatsoever. So by implication, the things we see visually have light reflecting off of them and all these things because they're parcels of matter and all these physical things. But if God is being itself, unlimited being, necessarily he can't be some physical thing for us to see. He is necessarily invisible. And this is precisely what the scriptures say. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. Colossians 1:15. 1 Timothy 6:16. Who alone possesses immortality and dwells in unapproachable light, whom no man has seen or can see. To him be honor and eternal dominion forever. Amen. So really the question is, how can an invisible God be accused of hiding? It's like saying, hey, did you guys see the invisible man in my house? No. That's what it means to be invisible. He was hiding right under the table. You didn't see him? It didn't matter where he was, because he's invisible. That's the whole point of being invisible. But God does reveal himself through his creation. We reason from effect to cause, just as we mentioned. Etienne Gilson puts it this way. He says, between the Christian God and things, there is a metaphysical fissure. The world only exists by a free ordinance of God. Consequently, it cannot be deduced from God. The human mind cannot have God as its natural and proper object. As a creature, it is directly proportioned only to created being. So much so that instead of being able to deduce the existence of things from God, it must, on the contrary, of necessity, rest on things in order to ascend to God. So we have this invisible God that we arrive at our knowledge of from things, reasoning from effect to cause. Now, of course, we have special revelation and those sorts of things in the Bible. And God also manifests himself in special ways that we read about throughout the Bible, in ways that we can sense. We can see it, hear it, touch it at times. Those sorts of things with our physical senses. Now, these are called theophanies. It comes from two Greek words meaning God and to appear. Now, theophany is a special appearance of God in various manifested forms. So you think of the pillar of fire by day, or the pillar of cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. Those sorts of manifested presences of God that we read about in the scriptures. And these were unusual events, usually reserved for very special circumstances, for specific purposes throughout scripture. God also reveals himself in miracles. Now, miracle is an act of God to confirm the message of God. So you think of things like the parting of the Red Sea, the burning bush, which may be a theophany or a miracle, whichever way you want to look at it, the virgin birth, these sorts of things, the resurrection. Okay, again, specific events for specific purposes. So we have some of these overlapping, again, of whether it's a theophany or a miracle, and not really relevant to our discussion tonight. So since no one can actually see this invisible God in the strict sense, what we're really talking about are these theophanies and miracles. Why doesn't God manifest his presence to everyone all the time so that we just know that he's there? Just like Richard Carrier was asking. Excuse me. Getting over a cold, so I apologize if I cough my way through this a little bit. Well, I think the best place to start in this discussion is to actually look at the argument. And I think I skipped a slide. So there are two ways to argue for the non-existence of something. Okay, so we're going to do some logic here. We're going to look at our second concept of how we think. Are we thinking well about this issue, and look at this from a logical standpoint first and foremost. So you may hear some people say, well, You can't prove the non-existence of anything. Have you been everywhere, examined every corner of the universe, turned over every rock to know that God doesn't exist? Well, I just think that's bad thinking. Okay, I think there are actually two ways to show the non-existence of something. So the first way to show that is to show that the thing in question is logically incoherent. So you think of something like a square circle. If I said, I was walking down the hall getting ready for the talk, I saw a square circle painted on the wall out there. How many of you would jump up and go try to find it? Hopefully no one, okay? Because those things aren't possible, right? It's not an existing thing. Or if I said, my best friend is a married bachelor, you would all look at me funny because you know such a thing is not possible. Married bachelors don't exist. Now, some people think God falls into this category because they misunderstand the Trinity, and they think the Trinity is actually a contradiction, which it's not. But they would say, well, if the Trinity is a contradiction, God might as well be a married bachelor. It can't be true. Now, again, that's just a misunderstanding of the Trinity when they try to do that. But the second way to show the non-existence of something is to show that the evidence that one would expect to see is absent. Now, this is a picture of Lowe's Home Improvement from Sanford, North Carolina, from a few years ago when a tornado went through. Very unusual, very powerful tornado in a different part of the country that doesn't usually experience those things. So if I said, this really powerful tornado roared, went through Sanford very strongly, that's easier to say, and tore down this Lowe's Home Improvement. And so you went to Sanford the next day, and you went to Lowe's. Everything's fine. No leaves on the ground, no sticks on the ground. Everything's in its place. What would you conclude about what I said? Either they rebuilt very quickly, or I wasn't telling the truth, right? That there was no tornado. But if you went and you saw this destruction, it would be a reasonable conclusion that, hey, there actually was a tornado or something that happened here. So the argument from divine hiddenness takes this approach to say that the evidence we should see or one would expect to see is lacking. And so we have no reason to think that this loving God exists. So let's look at the actual argument. Okay, so premise one says if there is a God, He's perfectly loving. Premise two, if a perfectly loving God exists, then no one could be a reasonable atheist. Premise three, but there are people who are reasonable atheists. Thus, no perfectly loving God exists. Thus, there is no God. Now, if you know anything about logic, this is a valid argument. That means the conclusion necessarily follows from the premises. Our question is it sound? Are the premises true? And this is where we're having to think well. Okay. Now, this comes from a man named Schellenberg, who has kind of popularized this argument. He thinks the argument hinges on premise two. Now, premise three, I think, is debatable for some people, although I'm convinced that I do have atheist friends who are quite reasonable and doing their best to think through these issues. So let's just take Schellenberg at his word and say it hinges on premise two. If a perfectly loving God exists, then no one could be a reasonable atheist. Well, the problem with this premise is this assumes a ton in this one statement. It assumes so much about God and how He would go about making His existence known and whether He would do so in some overwhelming fashion. Excuse me. So this assumes that God is loving and would want people to enter into a personal relationship with Him, and that people would need to know He exists prior to entering into such a relationship. I think Carrier does the same thing. Read his quote again. He says, God would have appeared and delivered His gospel personally to the whole world and would still be doing so. I would do so if I were in His position, and God can't be more compassionate than I am in that respect. Now notice here that he is presuming to know what God would and should do in order to make His presence known and deliver the gospel. It's a pretty big presumption on the part of Carrier, or assumption on the part of Carrier, to know what God would and should do in order to deliver His gospel to this world. How could he or any other atheist possibly know such a thing? Now, here's the thing. We might could think about what we would do if we had God's power. If we had unlimited power, man, what would we do with that? You know, Bruce Almighty, the movie with Jim Carrey, kind of tries to get into some of these issues. But we can't know what we would do with God's knowledge. Because remember, God is being itself, unlimited being. That means God has unlimited knowledge. Complete. He actually is knowledge itself. Now, how would you know what you would do if you had knowledge itself, unless you had knowledge itself? You couldn't possibly know what you would do with that kind of knowledge. Because really, here's the issue. It's not a difference in the amount of knowledge between us and God. It's a difference in how we know. So it's not like we could learn for an eternity and gain knowledge, and we're approaching the knowledge of God. Because it's not a difference in amount. It's not a quantitative difference. It's a qualitative difference. God doesn't learn. God knows. He is knowledge itself. That doesn't mean he's not reasonable, but he doesn't reason. He doesn't form syllogisms and come to conclusions. He is knowledge itself, something we can never approach and never even imagine what it would be like to have. So we can't make these types of presumptions. Excuse me. And would overwhelming evidence actually convince all reasonable people? Now, I'm very quickly reminded of the Israelites. I mean, they had these theophanies. They had these miracles. And yet, what do? Idol worship, stiff-necked, this, that, and the other. The same thing you and I would do, just admit it. We would all have been just as big a knuckleheads as they were if we were in their position. You think back to the disciples and, you know, how they denied Jesus and all. Oh, I would have never done that. If I was Jesus' disciple. He's doing all these things, amazing miracles. Yes, we would have, because we would just have been just as big a knuckleheads. They had all this stuff, and they're still worshiping golden calves, and they're still doing this, still doing that, getting punished and sent off to exile and all these things. And they had all the things that we're saying we want when it comes to this type of issue. Even some people attributed Jesus' miracles to demonic activity. Here's Jesus, God in human flesh, doing all these things. Oh, he's got a devil. He must be possessed, even with Jesus. And I had this conversation with an atheist friend of mine on Facebook a while back. And we were talking about, he actually started the conversation, and we were talking about what it would take to convince him that God exists. And he says, no, for me, the miracles I mentioned are so far out of what I know to be true in our naturalistic world that I would have to consider supernatural causes. Wasn't that the intent of your question? If I had said nothing, then you would have said I was closed-minded. Too many theists think that atheists will not consider the possibility of the supernatural. If a person is a science-based thinker, it means that all natural causes for something have been reasonably, if all natural causes for something have been reasonably ruled out, not that the supernatural is impossible. So he basically told me, you know, if God wrote something in the sky, Tom, this is God, I love you, or whatever, then he would have to consider the possibility of God. And I say, not so fast. You're being intellectually dishonest. Because you, this particular individual, are a metaphysical naturalist. You don't think supernatural things exist at all. You think only physical things exist. So if you saw something physical that was unusual, you have no foundation whatsoever to come to the conclusion that God, a supernatural being, did it. Because you've ruled that out from the very beginning. You would be making the classic God of the gaps fallacy argument. The very thing they accuse Christians of doing. Oh, you don't know what did that? Oh, God must have done it. You plug God into the gap of your knowledge. That's precisely what he was saying. He just admitted, well, I would just commit the God of the gaps argument and be done with it. And I'm thinking, and you think I'm the unreasonable one here? You've just said that's the very thing that's not possible. We know they would come up with some quantum fluctuation theory of something, or swamp gas, or some physical explanation, maybe unknown previously to try to explain away this phenomenon. Paul K. Moser, who I disagree with most of the time, said something I do agree with. He says, if you demand a universally convincing, undeniable manifestation of God, you should consider whether that is really a viable demand. For any amazing manifestation, you could coherently ascribe a source, however implausible, without making reference to God. The strange possibilities are endless. So the atheists would have to modify their argument to claim that there's no good reason for God to not make his existence more obvious. But again, how would they possibly know such a thing? It's simply not something they can know. So when we look back at the argument, we can see that premise two simply is not supportable. It can't be supported in the argument, which means the argument, therefore, is unsound. Sure. No problem. So the argument doesn't support that God does not exist. But of course, it still seems to have some emotional force. We want to think that God would just make himself so obvious that it would be easy to believe, and we wouldn't have all of these issues we have to deal with in apologetics and these sorts of things. We'd like to think that an all-loving, all-knowing God would just be more obvious and do a better job of showing himself than it seems that he's doing. So why doesn't he do that? Are there any good answers that we can give? So this brings us to our third concept, how we react. Because now we're really talking about the emotional, existential side of things. And we need to be very careful. I need to be very careful to make sure that my emotions, my feelings, are being judged in light of what I know. That my will is following my intellect. Not that I am being led by my emotions and feelings that are then influencing my will, that's then driving my intellect. So now I'm trying to figure out how to attain this thing that I just want to be true, rather than actually coming to knowledge of the truth and then pursuing that with my will. And we've reversed that in our culture. Sadly, we've reversed that in the church far too often. So there aren't any definitive answers, but I do think there are some reasonable ones that we can at least examine and think about. There are a few different approaches to tackling this particular issue. I want to look at two. The first one, I think, is probably the most popular, the morally significant choice explanation. And maybe you're familiar with this one. Again, I think this is probably the most common approach. And it argues that God partially hides himself to maintain our free will. Because if he made his existence more obvious, then he would overwhelm our free will and we wouldn't freely come to him. We would be coerced into coming to him. And by free will, I just mean that our actions are self-determined to whatever extent that may be. So again, it argues that we wouldn't be coerced into loving God. Now, oftentimes this is illustrated with something like a police officer or a highway patrolman. Now, you know, those of you who drive, what's the first thing you do when you see a patrolman sitting on the side of the road? Regardless of how fast you're going, what do you do?
Slow down.
You might already be going 5 miles below the speed limit, and your foot's still going to go to the brake, isn't it? Because you're coerced into obeying the speed limit at that point, so you don't get a ticket, right? That's kind of how this approach takes God's hiddenness. That if he was always sitting on the side of the road, so to speak, then we would be coerced into behaving ourselves and loving him and praying and all these things that if he wasn't there, we would not do otherwise. And there's a little merit to that, certainly. Another illustration that's given is the story of the king and the peasant girl. It's the story of this king who's riding through his kingdom and he falls in love with this beautiful peasant girl. And so his servant says, would you like me to go get her for you? He says, no, I'm afraid if she came to me knowing that I was the king, that she would feel coerced into loving me and marrying me and these things just because of my authority. So he disguises himself as a peasant, goes into the village, woos her, wins her heart, then reveals that he's the king so that she truly loved him. Good story. Some merit there, some ties to the gospel could certainly be made there with Jesus incarnating himself and those sorts of things. But I think there are two counter arguments to that example. Namely, Adam and Eve. And let me get a sip of water, and I'll explain what I mean. Pizza for supper before speaking. Not a good idea. So we know God created Adam, created Eve from Adam, placed them in the garden, gave them charge over the creation, commanded them not to eat from one tree. And it's another thing, you know, we think, well, if I was in the garden, I would have listened to God. We would have never been in this mess. Yes, we would. We all admit it. My name's Adam, so I can't even get away from it. It's always my fault. So the common understanding of Adam and Eve is that they were placed in the garden to be farmers, basically, right? To tend the garden. Now, this comes from Genesis 2:15. It says, then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar. I'm going on the authority of our professor Tom Howe on this, who is a Hebrew scholar. But I think he makes a very good case that we've misunderstood what this verse is actually communicating. Because the word for put here is not the typical word for put. It actually means to rest, or God causing to rest. And the verbs cultivate and keep do not agree in gender with garden. So the word it in the original, that's added in the English. The words it are not there in the original. And they don't. If that's referring to the garden, it doesn't agree in gender with cultivate and keep, which in Hebrew they should agree in gender. So it seems that it can't be referring to cultivating and keeping the garden. So what exactly is going on here? Well, the word for cultivate can actually mean to serve or to worship. And the word for keep can also mean to obey a command. And we actually see these used together in Deuteronomy 10, 12 and 13. It says, now Israel, what does the Lord your God require from you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways and love him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the Lord's commandments and his statutes, which I am commanding you today for your good. We read in Genesis 1:21 that the garden was already providing food for Adam before he started working it. God rested him in the garden. The garden provided for him, and he had to work the ground after the fall. It was part of the curse. So if we reread this verse with these meanings, then the Lord God took the man and rested him in the Garden of Eden to serve and worship and obey God. It gives a slightly different meaning to the passage, doesn't it? In other words, Adam and Eve knew the king was the king. They were placed there to serve and obey the king. And to whatever extent they knew that, they obviously had more knowledge of it than we currently do. They had the theophanies of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, if that's what was happening. However that worked, they had different knowledge of God than we do. Yet, their freedom wasn't overwhelmed. Now, they didn't see God in all his glory. That would have overwhelmed their free will. Now let me explain what I mean. John 3:2 says, beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not appeared as yet what we will be. We know that when he appears, we will be like him, because we will see him just as he is. That's heaven. It's what we call the beatific vision. Seeing God in all his glory. God supernaturally giving us knowledge of himself. Something we can't come to in our human limited capacity to know. So had Adam and Eve experienced this, their freedom would have been overwhelmed. Because once you experience the beatific vision, your free will is intact, but you can no longer sin. Because you don't want it. Sin is just pursuing something you take to be good, and you're just wrong about it. Or you're pursuing it in the wrong way. God is goodness itself. Seeing him in all his glory fulfills every longing and desire we could possibly ever have. We don't want anything else when that happens. Kind of like the bug going to the light, you know, the light, and you can't turn away. It's the beatific vision of God in all His glory. Now, Adam and Eve didn't have this, even though they had more knowledge of God than we certainly do, whatever that looks like. But again, we know their freedom wasn't overwhelmed because we're still reaping the consequences of their free choice today. So they knew the king was the king, yet they were able to choose to disobey. They weren't coerced into obeying. So I think, rightly or wrongly, a better approach to why God is somewhat hidden is simply the effects of human sin. Now, that may seem simplistic, but I probably don't mean it in the way you may think that I do. So let's unpack this just a little bit. Why doesn't God just appear in theophanies or whatever as He did with Adam and Eve today? If that didn't overwhelm their freedom, why would it overwhelm our freedom? We're human beings as well. Well, again, I think this helps us understand that issue. So look at two main areas with this. The first is that sin affects, obviously, man's relationship to God. Now, that doesn't mean that God changes, but it does mean our relationship to Him changes. It's like, you know, if I have a column here and I'm standing on this side of it and I move over here, it's not the column that changed. It's my relationship to the column that changed. And sin affects our relationship to God. So there's an illustration I like to do that I didn't bring the stuff to do tonight. Peter Kreeft uses this, talking about pre-fall Adam and Eve. And he uses three metal rings and a magnet. So if I have a powerful magnet here and I stick one ring to it and it sticks, it's magnetized, what happens if I stick another ring to it? It's going to stick, right? If I stick another one. Well, imagine if those three rings are intellect, will, and nature, reality. So when they're properly connected to God, our will follows our intellect, we're integrated with nature in a way that we're not negatively affected by nature. The garden, the special place where God rested Adam and Eve. But when that tie is severed, and I take that top ring off the magnet, what happens to the others? They fall apart, right? The magnetism is gone. The harmony is no longer there. And so this sin has severed that relationship with God in some form or fashion. And I think it's interesting, too, when we see the Adam and Eve sin, what does it say that they did when they hear God walking in the cool of the garden? They hid, right? They were the ones doing the hiding, not God. It's quite the opposite from what we may think. So Genesis 2, 16 and 17 says, spiritual death is the consequence of the sin. Now, obviously, we're talking about spiritual death, not physical death, immediately, because Adam and Eve didn't die immediately. So in this context, we're talking about spiritual death. And Dr. Geisler puts it this way. He says, death is separation and spiritual death is spiritual separation from God. Consequently, by spiritual death, which occurred at the very moment he sinned, Adam lost his relationship with his Creator. Likewise, as we have seen, all his descendants are naturally dead in trespasses and sins. Excuse me. So I think we need to understand that the purpose of God revealing Himself and these theophanies and these miracles, that sort of thing, if we look at those in context, it wasn't for the salvation of that particular person or even that particular group of people that were experiencing those things. It was for a greater purpose to bring about salvation to everyone. Just think about Moses and the burning bush, right? That wasn't necessarily for Moses. That was to bring about a people of God. It had a much larger context than just this one experience Moses was personally having with this crazy thing called this burning bush. Romans 3, 23 through 26, familiar passage of Scripture, says, for all have sinned to fall short of the glory of God, being justified as a gift by His grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in His blood through faith. This was to demonstrate His righteousness, because in the forbearance of God He passed over the sins previously committed for the demonstration, I say, of His righteousness at the present time, so that He would be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. So it seems that all of history leads to this culminating moment, the resurrection of Jesus. All of these miracles, theophanies, all of these things pointing to Christ. The fulfillment of this redemption plan, start of the church, and the hope of our salvation. So it's actually the fact that God doesn't leave us completely in the dark that should humble us. That we're able to know anything about Him at all. That He condescends to reveal even more of Himself to us than we're able to naturally reason to. That should humble us. Not cause us to question, why don't you do more, God? Why do you do anything, God? Because you don't owe me any more than I can naturally attain. And my natural ability to attain knowledge of God is not salvific knowledge. That has to be revealed to us in special revelation. But this also does not only affects man's relationship to God, it also affects man's relationship to reality. In kind of the way I mentioned with the magnets and the rings illustration. So our unhindered relationship with creation, our wills perfectly following our intellects, that this type of pre-fall existence that Adam and Eve had was corrupted. It was severed upon the fall. So now at the fall, I'm convinced, and several of us at the seminary teach this, I'm convinced that the fall is a fall from supernatural grace, a supernaturally graced state of Adam and Eve, down to mere humanity. So it's not that Adam and Eve were some kind of superhumans, and at the fall, well, now we're some kind of subhuman, and we exist as these subhuman kind of things. No, Adam and Eve were human beings. We share the same nature as Adam and Eve. Jesus Christ couldn't be the last Adam, and He shared our nature if Adam had a different nature. So they have a supernaturally graced state fallen to mere humanity. So now we're in this mere humanity state. And I think we'll have time for questions at the end. I think we'll get through that and be okay with that. Ed Fazer puts it this way. Long quote, but I think it's worth reading. He says, "But as with other creatures, while nature provides the means to our ends, she doesn't guarantee that every one of us will in fact realize those ends. Due to intellectual error and the complexity of the philosophical issues, some of us sometimes fail properly to understand the main arguments for God's existence, or mix all sorts of errors into whatever knowledge of God we do have. Due to the weaknesses of our wills, we also fall into moral error. And when moral and intellectual errors multiply throughout a culture, as we see every day, the resulting general social environment may make it difficult for a given individual living within it to avoid more numerous and more serious moral and intellectual errors than he otherwise would have been prone to." And we see that every day we walk out the door. That just is the culture we're in. And this is why I think it is fair to say there are reasonable atheists who are just in this culture prone to bad thinking, that have layer after layer after layer of bad thinking to peel away in order to think well about the arguments and those sorts of things that we may present in our apologetics. And I changed my notes, so I don't remember what slide is next. So again, we have man's relationship to God being affected, man's relationship to reality being affected, and because man's mind has been darkened, it can be darkened to the true and the good. And this habitual choosing the bad, the evil, the base, just continues to influence those decisions over and over and over, so a person can essentially bury themselves deeper and deeper and deeper into this bad thinking, so that we can even perceive God, but come to the point that we don't want to receive Him. We may understand the arguments and just don't care. We just don't want it to be true. And at that point, it is a matter of the will. The intellect, you can answer all the intellectual arguments all day long, and you should. But ultimately, it's a matter of the will. And when a person comes to that point, all we can do is pray, essentially. We've done everything that we can. But God does promise, Hebrews 11:6, "Without faith it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to Him must believe that He exists and He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. So again, I think we can be better equipped to at least try to navigate this idea and problem of divine hiddenness by thinking about, if it'll come up, how we know, how our knowledge of God works from effect to cause, thinking about how we think, and seeing that the argument, the formal argument, simply just doesn't work from a logical perspective, and then thinking about how we react, and making sure that we're checking our feelings and our emotions in light of what we know, and that our wills are following our intellects. So free will is certainly part of the answer, but ultimately I think our sin, the fall, is really the ultimate answer as to why we're experiencing this mere humanity that is subject to this type of corrupt thinking and just missing some of the arguments and being prone to digging ourselves deeper and deeper into this bad thinking. But this, all of this reminds me of another time when I was about 12 years old. I guess a lot happened during those years. I don't remember the name of the comet. Wasn't Halley's Comet or something like that. It was one that doesn't come around, but you know, every so many hundred years or something. But it was supposed to be just the brightest comet. You didn't need a telescope to see it. It was going to be this magnificent thing. And I grew up right in the middle of North Carolina in Chatham County near Jordan Lake, if any of you know where that is. And it's near Chapel Hill, Moorhead Planetarium, Matar Hill, go Tar Heels, sorry. We played terrible last weekend, but it's okay. But Moorhead Planetarium took their telescopes out, you know, the little fat round ones that are about that big but super powerful. They went out to Jordan Lake, pitch black, middle of the night, so you could go see the comet. So my dad and I got up in the middle of the night, you know, drive to Jordan Lake, go to see this comet. Well, they had a telescope set up to Saturn, could literally see the rings on Saturn with this little telescope. It was amazing. I remember a satellite was going over and it turned just right, so the sun over the horizon reflected off of the solar panels, you know, and it flashed real quick and then it kept on going. It was just really cool. We know as a kid, I loved all this stuff. So finally we wait in line, we get to the telescope to see this comet. And you couldn't see anything. You literally had to look beside of the comet to see this little fuzzy white haze out of the corner of your eye. And the astronomer said, yeah, that's the comet. It wasn't as bright as we thought it was going to be, but that's it. So, you mean I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning to come out for this white fuzz? Are you kidding me? At least I got to see the rings of Saturn, but hey, come on. I wanted to see the comet. But you know what my dad and I didn't conclude? That there was no comet. We didn't see what we thought should have been there. It wasn't as bright as we thought it was going to be and as clear as we thought it was going to be. But we had enough evidence to conclude that, yeah, there's a comet there. It just doesn't look like what I thought it was going to. And I think that's analogous to this situation. We don't have to have overwhelming, even though I think we actually do have overwhelming evidence, but the evidence doesn't have to look like we think it should look to conclude that God exists. We have the evidence there that we have to contend with, that everyone has to contend with, whether it's the kind of evidence they wish was there or not. It's still there, and it has to be dealt with. Acts 14, 16 and 17 says, "In the generations gone by, He permitted all the nations to go their own ways, and yet He did not leave Himself without witness, in that He did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." We have numerous scientific, philosophical arguments for the existence of God, even that necessarily conclude in the existence of God and this certain nature and all of these wonderful things that you can learn about in all of the sessions that are going on this weekend. He's giving us more than just this one light at the end of the hallway. He's given us this amazing reality that He's given us the ability to reason about and come to these awesome conclusions of who He is, just on our own. And then He's condescended to give us this word, this thing we call the Bible, that tells us even more about Him and His plan of salvation and this work of redemption that culminates in Christ. And really, Jesus is the final answer to this, isn't He? Just like the argument from evil, Jesus puts the last nail in the coffin, so to speak, of the argument with the nails that are holding Him to the cross. This is Hebrews 1:3. He is the radiance of His glory, the exact representation of His nature, and upholds all things by the word of His power. When He had made purification of sins, He sat down at the right hand of majesty on high. John 1:18 says, "No one has seen God at any time, the only begotten God who was in the bosom of the Father. He has explained Him. Yet even He was rejected." So if Jesus, the radiance of God, is rejected when He walks the earth, we shouldn't really be surprised when people maybe reject our arguments for God because they're just not thinking well about these things. But it is possible to think well about these things and to reason through some of these things. So does God play hide and seek? Well, in a sense He does. But as we said, it's really the opposite. Luke 19:10, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." We're the ones hiding. He's the one seeking us. And I'm grateful that He is. So I think we have about 10 minutes for comments, questions, Rotten Tomatoes, or the like. And as Richard Howe says, we'll just actually do questions. We don't do answers. But you're free to ask anything you would like. That session is at 8:30 in the morning, I think. Questions, comments? And the PowerPoint for this is not on the app yet. I will try to get that uploaded tonight, so you'll be able to download the PDFs off of our NCCA app if you'll download that.
I don't see one reason for God not giving us overwhelming evidence is that He requires faith on our part.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think faith is?
It's a leap of some sort, a reasonable leap, I believe, but it takes, at some point, you have to make that leap.
Okay. I would disagree that it's a leap. Okay, I agree with the fact that it is reasonable. So we would say that faith is simply trust in an authority. So when we say we have faith in God, we're taking Him at His word. Because He's an authority on matters that deal with sin, on matters that deal with us, things that we don't have access to. And so when He tells us something that we can't reason to, and we say, "You're God, You're an authority, I trust You," that's faith. So I would actually say I don't have faith that God exists. Because I can reason to a conclusion based on evidence that God exists. Now, some people do. They just believe it because the preacher says so, or mom and dad says so, or whatever. It doesn't make their belief any less real, but it's certainly not a reasoned belief. So I have faith that Jesus died for my sins, that He was God in human flesh, that God exists as a Trinity. These things that I can't reason to, that God tells me, and so I take Him at His word. Agree in with his authority on the matter, but with the fact that, you know, we could go through arguments and premises to give you a reasoned conclusion that therefore God exists. By definition, that's not a matter of faith in that sense.
But you won't move your feet.
But I won't move my feet.
That's right.
In what
other
is
words,
that?
Faith is moving your feet.
Yes, it is an active trust. Yes.
Conclusion,
right.
I say you won't move your feet.
Why is that?
Because you have to have faith. There has to be something more than that reasonable.
Right, yes, the reason.
Reasonable process.
Right, the reason gives me reason to trust in God's authority. So kind of like if I go to a doctor, right, or if I'm walking down the street and a stranger comes up and says, "Hey man, take this pill right now or you're going to die." And I say, "Oh, gee, give me a glass of water. Thank you so much for telling me." That would be insane, right? Is it aspirin? Is it arsenic? What's going on? But if I went to my doctor, who I have reason to believe is credentialed and all these things, he runs a battery of tests on me. I leave. A few minutes later, he comes walking, running up to me. "I got the results of your test. Take this pill right now or you're going to die." Now, granted, I might want a second opinion, have some questions, but my reaction is going to be different, right? Because he's my doctor. He has access to information to which I don't have, and I choose to trust in his authority or not. But it's a reasoned trust. And you're right, faith is that step, that step of trust. But it is based on that reason. Does that make sense? Okay. Good question. Anything else? Anyone? Questions? quiet group.
Thank you.
Yep.
Have any other authors done? Are there many books that are much
reading? There are a few. Actually, this is based on a paper I wrote a long time ago, and I can't even remember all the research I did for the paper. I didn't agree with a lot of it's kind of the free will kind of defense and those sorts of things. There is a paper I got just the other day, actually, by Dumsdy, I think is his last name. It's towards a Thomistic response to divine hiddenness, where he gets into a few more of these issues, and I didn't get into nearly all the things he talks about in the paper. But I think that is a little better approach than just this, well, God doesn't want to overwhelm our free will. Well, okay, but you got to nuance that a little bit more than just a blanket statement like that. So there is some, not a lot. I think there needs to be more work done from a more philosophical, or at least better philosophical perspective, than most of the time is out there.
Maybe that's your cue to
rate. Yeah, right. Anybody else? Yep.
Yeah, on the one significant choice, talking about how he wants us to maintain our free will. And otherwise we would be coerced to love him. So wouldn't that go against the omnipresence?
Would that go against the omnipresence of God? Well, that depends on what you mean by omnipresence. And how that look, what that looks like. So what do you mean exactly? Yep. Well, that's the argument they're trying to make. That the free will argument makes is if God manifested himself in some theophany or something for everyone all the time, that would coerce us into following him and obeying him and all those sorts of things. I'm saying, I think Adam and Eve are counterexamples to that because they had that kind of manifested presence of God and they weren't coerced into obeying him. They still chose to disobey. And so I just don't think that morally significant choice argument really holds as an answer to the problem of divine hiddenness. Yep.
So kind of tie it to that, kind of like a security camera. If you stick a security camera right there, maybe the first few days, you know, you'll be more aware of it and you'll behave better. But after a while, you're just going to get used to it. So
yeah, true. Problem. Yes, ma'am.
But then this relates more to the angelology. But then how did Lucifer fall if he was in the presence of God? He still had free will. He made a choice.
Absolutely. And however that works, which is very speculative because we're only given so much information about that, which is really what we have to go on. That's more of a revealed type of theology. Whatever that looks like, at that moment, they had not experienced the beatific vision of God. So whatever knowledge they had of God was still a limited knowledge. So it still maintained that ability to choose. Yeah, angelology is a weird thing that I'm not an expert in by any means, but those are always the questions that come up because they obviously are logical extensions of some of this. So, good question. Yep.
Just on that issue, because Lucifer, he is the cause of all, he actualized his free will that caused all things or all beings after that to choose on the basis of the freedom that has now been caused by God. So how I view that actualization of Lucifer is this functionality in that all beings that are created to function in accordance to design. And when one chooses not to function according to design, because as Isaiah said, and he wanted to be like God, this world. And to be like God is not to function or to have any means of operation or change or growth. And God is the only thing that doesn't grow, change, and develop. However, Lucifer was designed to change, develop, and function as he was. And he said, I will be like God. And this is what we all trying to be. Now, so it's like a repeat of that.
Sure.
The first example not to follow, but we tend to follow because we want to be like and not be what we have been designed.
Yeah, and actually that's exactly what we mean by, from a natural law standpoint that we teach at the seminary, that's exactly what we mean by good and bad or evil. Good is just to fulfill the end or purpose of something according to its nature, according to what it is. And to act contrary to our nature just is to pursue what is necessarily bad for us. And that, yeah, that's just exactly what natural law teaches in a nutshell. Yep. Pete, do you want to say something?
I'll talk to him later because it was a kind of a thought that I had on. Well, I'll say it right now. Okay. If God is
30 seconds.
If God is invisible, right? If God is invisible, he's omnipresent. You're talking about his omnipresence. If he's right here, like literally right here, and he's invisible, I couldn't see him anyways.
Right, and that's why we're talking about these theophanies, or these manifestations of God. And just to be clear, omnipresence of God just means he's causally active everywhere that something exists. He's currently sustaining us in existence at this moment. So in that sense, he is present everywhere that his sustaining cause is, which he's the sustaining cause of all reality other than himself, so he is everywhere, right? Yep.
And just as Henry was saying, like, if God is invisible, is your perspective, is your view on God. So if you view God as a non-relational person, then he could be viewed as a camera that is placed on the side, that is there, that is in there. But once you have a relationship with him, he doesn't become invisible, but he becomes knowable in every action. So now the responsibility is not on God per se, but is on you now carrying out your responsibility as a secondary agent in reference to your
And which for us is ultimately manifested in the presence of Christ, just as we saw. Thank you guys so much for coming. I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Appreciate you being here.